This is Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust. Hello, hello. Welcome back to Vulnerability Matters. I'm Chris Fitch. Today's episode asks the simple question, what should we do about online influencers? There are now hundreds, if not thousands, of online creators sharing videos about their lived experience of neurodivergence, disability, and other circumstances. But while these stories can be powerful, relatable, and reassuring, some creators have been criticized for offering advice and guidance that is misleading because it appears to be based solely on their own personal experience. And that's where today's guest comes in. Matt Gupwell, a creator with his own lived experience in neurodivergence, has made it his mission and that of his organisation, Think Neurodiversity, to challenge evidence-free content. So I asked Matt to take us backstage into the world of online neuroinfluencers and to explain why he believes content with millions of views routinely misses the mark, recycles unsubstantiated myths, and may even spread harmful advice with little or no evidence to support it.
So Matt, thanks for being here. Just tell us a bit about yourself and what you do.
I class myself as a neurodivergent educator. So I work as a consultant, advising businesses and providing neurodiversity awareness training and consultancy. I mentor individuals with ADHD and autism, with a special focus on people who are very late diagnosed, so typically over 40 years old, and I'm a dad and a husband to a neurodivergent family. So this thing called neurodiversity is my world.
Let's really kind of hone into the premise of today's episode, the idea of balancing lived experience with evidence, which we're going to bring to life by looking at neurodiversity. Why does that balance and tension matter to you so much at Think Neurodiversity?
Because the concept of neurodiversity isn't about conditions or labels or deficits or superpowers. It's about people. And it's about the fact that people's brains may and do work differently. So if we start from that point of we're talking about people rather than labels, the evidence piece is how we learn what it means to be told our brain may work differently to what's defined as a norm. And if we lean on the evidence that we've got, knowing that over time that evidence will change and develop, what we get is, for me, a stable, useful baseline of this is the conversation. The flip side to that is if we only ever base that conversation about what neurodiversity is on opinion or conjecture or what's known as lived experience, whilst there is validity to that, what we're not getting is confirmation that everyone does experience the same thing, feel the same thing, act the same way. So it has to be a balance, but the tension is there, probably more so than ever, because evidence is slow. Research is slow. And because it's slow, people seem to perceive that means it's not happening. When it is, it just takes a long time to fund a research paper and conduct the research and collate the research and then have it peer reviewed before it even gets published. But it takes seconds to take out your phone and make a reel and post it on social media with a opinion. And that's where the tension is. So for me, I'm trying to, I use this phrase, bridge the gap in everything I do. I'm trying to pull the two sides closer together and say, you can have your opinions, but if you cannot reference where you believe that information to be true, then that's all it is, your opinion. And that means you can't apply it to everyone.
So in your own work then, we've talked about kind of your position on this with clients and with others. How are you going about consuming and evaluating the content that's out there on neurodiversity in relation to this balance between people and the evidence?
Well, the starting point is I try to make sure that everything I do is based in critical thinking. Okay. I endeavor as much as possible to make sure that I'm checking in with my own bias and my own opinion and my own sort of thoughts. And I'm holding that up against everything I'm seeing. So let's start with this thing. We're talking about what for a lot of people is an esoteric concept. What is neurodiversity? Now, anyone listening's probably heard this banding around, and we're hearing an awful lot of conversation to distill this down to some commonly heard things about ADHD and autism particularly. What that's causing is a lot more conversation about these things, but an awful lot more misinformation about these things and confusion. And that's the nature of the world we live in, that we get this confusion and these mixed messages. So for me, when I am consuming content and looking at content and accessing content, what I try to always do is try to listen for or look for the grains of original concept, the grains of truth, if you like, in what somebody's saying. So the way I explain it is, it's kind of like echoes. We hear that, you know, I use the phrase, it's an echo chamber a lot. At some point, somewhere, somebody had an original and probably researched and evidenced thought that they shared. What's happened is, over a period of time, that's been seen and repeated and seen and repeated, but slightly changed, and seen but repeated and slightly changed again. So what we get is something that sounds correct, but it's so far removed from what the original concept or the original information was that now it's incorrect and potentially causes confusion. The challenge is, when people see content, they don't very often have the time or the inclination to go, do you know what? I think I'm going to go and try and find the source for that. Nobody really cares to do that unless they're invested in the research. Now, I am. For me to access the research has been quite difficult. So I've had to build links with clinical partnerships and with academics and researchers who will share information with me, who will treat me as a peer to say, look, Matt, have you seen this? And that then helps me put content out that perhaps seems challenging, seems different, but it's always got the same aim. I want people to stop and do that critical thinking and go, just because that post has been really well presented or edited does not mean it's factually correct.
Hmm. So you're trying to give a tug on the chain of whispers and to follow that chain backwards to its origin to see what was originally said. So tell us a bit about Think Neurodiversity and how you then build that into your work.
So Think Neurodiversity really was a concept that I'd had in my mind since my kids were diagnosed. But as parents, my wife and I became obsessed after our oldest was diagnosed and subsequently our youngest. So come 2021, early 2022, during COVID, I'd been diagnosed myself clinically with ADHD for about a year. And I knew that there was a change of career from being a professional entertainer and mouthpiece to a mouthpiece in a different way. I was already talking about this with corporate clients. It's not me trying to tell people what neurodiversity is. It's getting them to stop and go away and learn and to understand. And over time, that's changed. So now I'm very passionate about putting the person before any label. We are in a framework now where a lot of the content we see is label first. And you hear things like, oh, I've got ADHD, so I can't. Well, you can't say that because I'm. And that's the wrong way to go about it. The right way to go about it is for people who are diagnosed or think they may be to know, what does this actually mean to me in the first place? What does it mean that I know I've got ADHD? How do I explain that to myself? And then how do I communicate that to others who may not know, but who may be basing what they think they know on the stuff they've seen on social media that might not be right or relevant to me. So that's what the neurodiversity still is. It's a hopefully a catalyst to make people stop, to think about what they're seeing, to check in with what they think they know, and actually to give people who are living it a chance to say, do you know, this is what it means to me.
So you've been working with organisations on neuroinclusion, if I use that term, for over 15 years. And from the description you've given there, you're both a consultant and a trainer and a content creator. So looking at some of that content creation, what's changed in that time in terms of the growth in online commentators and influencers, showing often really personal, not just neurodivergent stories, but advice based on their story?
What's changed is the volume, the veracity, and the inconsistency of information, in my opinion. So really, 2020 on was the biggest change, the explosion of social media and of real based information. So the TikTok and the Instagram and the reels that maybe we see on Facebook. Now, the research would tell us, there have been multiple studies now, the efficacy and the safety of online content, particularly about ADHD and autism as a focus. And time and again, the research will say, on average, 60 to 70% of the content that is shared and the information that's shared online is factually incorrect, clinically incorrect, and is potentially harmful to the people consuming it. But there's nothing to stop that content being made. The reason I create content in my way is because I can't be accused of being in the pocket of anything, because I'm not. I don't get paid by the industry. I get paid by my clients. And because I've mentored individuals for so long, because I've worked with private clients for so long, I, in my own mind, feel I've got an ability to speak from both sides. But the content I produce is always based in either challenging the narratives and saying, yeah, okay, everyone says this, but why? Where is the evidence for that? Or here's some new evidence. Here's a different opinion. And so the way I try to do that is to distill the myths about neurodiversity.
One of the parallels that we see with organisations and employers is lists of reasonable adjustments to make with staff members with particular conditions. And I know you love lists, Matt.
Oh, yeah.
You've got a special approach to this. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, so look, again, lists of anything can't work in the way they're being presented. Now, I will preface this by saying some of these lists could be good starting points for a conversation. Unfortunately, what they've been taken as is definitives, right? Oh, well, I've seen these seven things, so we're just going to say everyone with ADHD gets these. Oh, it didn't work for you. Well, never mind. I was told it would. That's not reasonable adjustments. That's not how reasonable adjustments work. My approach that I've worked with the NHS on, that I've worked with organisations on, is to say the only person that knows what they struggle with and how, even if they don't quite understand why, is the person who is struggling. So therefore, if we want to get better at implementing reasonable adjustments, we have to get away from the label. We have to get away from the diagnosis being important. And we have to get back to that person who says, for example, I'll use a really common one. I work in an open plan office when I have to come into work and I cannot concentrate because of the noise. Okay. If you go online now and search reasonable adjustments for people struggling with noise, I promise you the number one is noise cancelling headphones. However, I know people who, if I gave them noise cancelling headphones, would be more overstimulated, because now all they can hear is the noise in their head, and that's worse. Mm-hmm. Right? So the conversation has to be, what noise is it that's causing you a problem? When is that noise causing you a problem? How does it impact you? What does it mean you can't do? How does that affect your ability to concentrate? What does that mean maybe you're not being able to complete? And what would different look like for you? What would better look like for you? And if we have conversations like that, based on a framework like "or which means what we get is a lot of context. We understand how people have tried to cope so far. And then we can start talking to them about, okay, can we now look at options? Can we build a virtual toolkit of some things that may all help the same thing that we could try implementing one at a time, and we can test and we can retest and we can accept that something may work for 6 weeks and then because of a change of circumstances or stimulation or external factors, it may now not work. And that doesn't mean you're now a problem manager out of the business. It means we have a conversation and go, okay, should we put that back in the toolbox and pick that up? Might that work under these circumstances? That's the approach I'm trying to get people to take. Again, it's back to the person, not the condition. But when managers, and every manager I'm talking to at the moment, if they're honest with me, is afraid of the same thing, when managers and HR professionals feel that they are supposed to be pseudo-clinical experts on multiple different conditions, not just one, on multiple different conditions that could be classed as neurodivergent, they get panicked. They begin to shut down. And I've seen it cause inaction rather than any action, which means people struggle more because it's overwhelming. And you don't need to be an expert in every condition. You need to remember what talking to a person about, what talking to a person is about, and have better conversations. Now, whenever I present that to my clients, they tell me it's the most validating thing they've heard. They feel that that's something they can go away and do. And they question, why have I not heard that before? And my honest belief is because we've got stuck in a label first narrative. Mm-hmm. And so I'm seen as some kind of a disruptor, and I'm seen as not being supportive and not being an ally and not being an advocate for other people with, when the reality is it's all I have been for 16 years. I'm just trying to remember that we're people first.
Accountability goes again to the heart of what we've been talking about, the balance between our experience as people and the experience of many people brought together as evidence. So just two last questions then. The first one is, if I'm consuming this material, what should I be looking for, or what should I be doing to ensure that I am acting upon something that's evidence-based rather than based on the experience of one person?
But I'm going to share the advice of a clinician I work with and in partnership with called Andrew Jay. And we discussed this on an episode of our podcast, and he recommended this. If you see a post, a reel, that seems plausible, spend 10 minutes trying to find at least three others that not only say the same thing, but that provide evidence for that opinion. Try and find that said by a clinician or a professional or a researcher. Go on to things like PubMed or Google Scholar and see if you can find it there as well. Yes. See if you can find the genesis of that post you saw. And if you can, you can say, okay, I take that as good evidence. If you can't, the likelihood is it isn't right. It isn't true. It is just opinion. And that's when you can make a decision to discount that. But that's the only way we can do it.
And if I'm a content creator, because we work with lots of consultants who wear two hats. They have lived experience and they're specialists in their own right, including creating their own material. You very rarely see citations or reference lists on the LinkedIn post.
Yeah.
What advice would you have for us all as content creators when we're approaching discussions like neurodiversity?
If you're going to start talking about something that's as important to other people as neurodiversity, whether it's through your own lived experience or someone else's, even if you don't want to publish citations, make sure you've looked at some. Make sure, again, that what you're saying is grounded in research and in evidence from the experience of people and the evidence of the research. And if you can't, same principle applies. If you cannot find the genesis of what you think you're about to say being absolutely grounded in truth, be honest and say, this is my opinion. I can't prove this, but this is how I feel. There's nothing wrong in that, right? It's more honest to say, I have no evidence for this, but this is what I experience. Great, fine, it's your opinion. You're being honest. Don't present it, though, as irrefutable truth and fact because it makes good content if you haven't got evidence for it, because it's not.
Matt, thank you very much for your time.
My absolute pleasure.
And that was Matt Gotwell, making a case for evidence-based online creator content. If you want to know more about Matt's work and content, you can find him at thinkneurodiversity.co.uk. But he's also well worth a follow on LinkedIn, where he regularly writes about how to blend research evidence with personal experience. And that's about it for today. So until next time we meet, keep it evidenced, keep it experienced, and always keep on remembering that vulnerability matters. Vulnerability Matters was produced by Mandy McGreevy and Phil King and brought to you by the Money Advice Trust.